Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
I'm really terrible with jokes, but here's a favorite of mine. It's from Mitch Hedwig, and it says something like, an escalator is never broken, it just becomes stairs.
I am Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download. 1 hour of culture, food, and humor to fuel your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from acclaimed author George Saunders. That'll help break the ice. He's got a new novel out, a ghost story of sorts, called Lincoln in the Bardo. We will talk to him about that later, and then he'll stick around to answer your etiquette questions. Plus, we chat with Damien Chazelle, director of the acclaimed movie musical La La Land.
Also coming up, Grammy-winning musician Rhiannon Giddens DJs a party with equal parts opera and blues. Chef Jason Kim invents a dessert salad, and we hear a new track from Sunkill Moon.
But first, small talk.
All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
National Security Advisor Michael Flynn forced to resign.
Adele won every Grammy Award for which she was nominated.
The evacuation order has been lifted for nearly 200,000 people below the Oroville Dam.
Now for something you might not have heard, we are joined by Erin McCann. She is senior staff editor with pink hair at the New York Times.
Oh, yes.
Erin, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I have a story about puppies.
Okay. The dog show is this week, so
it
puppies
is.
Abound.
There are 3,000 dogs in town this week.
In New York City for the Westminster Dog Show.
Exactly. And many of them are staying at the Hotel Pennsylvania across the street from Madison Square Garden, where the Westminster Dog Show is taking place. And the Washington Post has written a story about all of the things that have to happen at this hotel to accommodate the sudden influx of puppies.
They need tons of plastic bags lying around on little rolls.
They give Claritin to all the guests.
Anyway, the biggest thing is space, extra cleaners on staff. They have one person who sort of has become the pooch concierge.
Oh my God.
He told the Washington Post that he is in charge of, quote, pooch relations and barketing.
Marketing.
Oh no, it gets better. He manages the paparazzi for this five-paw hotel.
I mean, you're talking to a guy who's never saw a bad pun he didn't like, but I feel like even this pooch concierge
is a bit much.
I actually love it because this guy clearly is in the right job.
That's true.
Yeah. He's like waited his whole life for this
and
moment.
It's probably not easy because these are famous puppies, so they're probably horrible nightmares. And in the penthouse suite, they're like throwing kittens.
There's rhinestone collars everywhere, and the dogs are fighting over them.
Kibble spattered against every wall.
Oh my gosh.
So one of the things that he told the Washington Post that the Hotel Pennsylvania does is they've taken an extra conference room in one of the floors of this hotel and they've transformed it as sort of a holding room for the dog.
Okay.
But treadmills in there. There is a 24-hour pee area whose sawdust is freshened hourly.
Wait, that's crazy. New York is a 24-hour pee area.
It is.
Well, that's the subway, is I think they're talking about.
I think they
could
have just let the dogs out, as it were.
By the way, I went to the dog show last night, and as you walk into the Madison Square Garden, Who Let the Dogs Out is playing in the lobby.
Oh my gosh.
And I like to imagine it's just playing on a loop 24/7 all week long.
Driving everyone except the dogs insane.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the small talk, Erin.
Absolutely.
And now time for Cocker Spaniel Tales.
Once again, we tell you something that happened this week in history, then get a bartender to capture its essence in cocktail form.
It's like history's a car radiator with booze for coolant.
Fascinating. First, the history part. This week, back in 1852, a man was born who changed what the world ate for breakfast.
Michelle Philippi's here to tell us about him.
John Harvey Kellogg wasn't your average 19th century doctor. At a time when the American diet was mainly meat and potatoes, he advocated vegetarianism. Today, we'd laud him for that, but we might question some other moves he said would lead to excellent health, like standing inside an electrified metal cage, or undergoing, sorry, there's no nice way to put this, daily water and yogurt enemas. At the Battle Creek Sanitarium in Michigan, John and his brother Will subjected willing clients to these and other unique health practices, and also put them on a diet of super bland foods. But one day, the brothers accidentally cooked up something kinda tasty. Apparently, Will boiled some plain old wheat, set it aside, and then ran off to attend to patients. When he got back, the wheat had gone stale. Will and John tried to roll the gunk into sheets, but instead it broke apart into flakes. These, the brothers toasted, and voila, a new kind of breakfast cereal. Or, as they called it, granos. Eventually, the brothers hit upon a granos recipe using corn and came up with a way better sounding name for it, cornflakes. Patients loved it, and soon Will set up a company to sell the stuff. Alas, John didn't share in the profits. He refused to join the company when his brother insisted on adding sugar to the recipe. Today, of course, Kellogg's cornflakes show up on breakfast tables worldwide, along with the familiar rooster logo on the box. By the way, while accounts vary, some say that logo's inspired by the Welsh word for rooster, Ceiliog.
That was the history. Now for a drink to serve along with it. I am on the line with Pamela Vaughn. She is a bartender at Clara's on the River in Battle Creek, Michigan, which was the site of Kellogg's Sanitarium and is still the company's headquarters. Pamela, a story about medical quackery and cornflakes. I don't envy you turning that into a cocktail, but what did you come up with?
We came up with a drink. We named it the John Harvey.
The John Harvey, of course, yes. After Mr. Kellogg.
Yes.
And a nice little breakfast smoothie.
A smoothie. Okay.
Yes.
So take me through making this thing.
So I put a full cup of milk in a blender. I put a tablespoon of honey, a tablespoon of cornflakes, and we used 5 dates.
Ah.
And then I used 3 cups of crushed ice. And I blended it all up and put some cornflakes on the top.
But where does the booze come in? What booze did you throw in?
We decided that we weren't going to do any booze. It's a more of a mocktail.
Oh.
Because John Harvey Kellogg was not really fond of drinking, and he was more on the healthy aspect of everything.
Do we have an idea of how against alcohol he was? Obviously, he was against a lot of stuff, including sugar.
Yeah, he was completely against it just because of the whole health aspect and because of his religion.
Oh, he was a Seventh-day Adventist, is that right?
It is right.
So they abstain from alcohol, I guess?
Yes, they do.
Well, there you go. Perfect for that crew. I have to say I'm a little sad this isn't somehow zapped with electricity. Like Kellogg's electric cage machine or something? Like,
I know.
Could you at least outline the glass with glowing wire?
Oh, how'd you know?
On the other hand, I do think some of Kellogg's other practices could have led you in some very unsavory directions.
Right.
So, America, thanks you for your restraint. All right, and you know, Brendan, one reason Kellogg favored bland foods?
Mm-hmm.
He thought sexual passion could lead to diseases like cancer, and
okay.
Bland food would decrease those passions.
All right.
That's
well,
Kellogg.
I guess there's nothing less sexy than cornflakes.
He did his job very well.
Muesli, on the other hand.
Anyway, people, you can find...
Good morning.
You can find plenty of mostly flavorful, now that I think of it, cocktail recipes at our website, dinnerpartydownload.org. All right, now let's pair that drink with a dinner party soundtrack.
And here with that is singer, songwriter, fiddler, and banjo maestro, Rhiannon Giddens. She makes up a third of the Grammy-winning folk band Carolina Chocolate Drops. And you can see her on the TV show Nashville as a banjo-toting social worker. Her second solo album comes out this week. It's called Freedom Highway, and it's named after the Civil Rights Anthem.
Here's Rhiannon with a playlist of alternately operatic and humble proportions.
This is Rhiannon Giddens, and this is my ideal dinner party soundtrack. My first song is Leontine Price singing O Patria Mia, 1962.
She's acclaimed as one of the greatest sopranos in the entire history of music.
Back in the 60s, the bell telephone hour was a thing. It was on sort of national TV, and they would have different singers come in and recreate scenes from the opera. Leontine Price is just one of the best. It's just she opens her mouth and, you know, I think I read somewhere that her own voice, like, would move her to tears. Oh, opera singing gets this bad rap, you know, this large woman with blonde braids and horns, you know, singing, ah, you know, singing this horrible music. And opera's just so amazing when it's sung beautifully, and the purity of her voice, I mean, particularly that last note, is just unreal. She managed to transcend race, really, in terms of just people saying she's one of the greats. Not she's one of the great black sopranos, but she's one of the greats. And, you know, as a black female entertainer, I'm always thinking about the people who managed to make it through those limitations to make it. You know, they couldn't be mediocre. They had to be, like, amazing.
Another big news story of the year concerned the Ecumenical Council in Rome, known as Vatican II.
My second song is The Vatican Rag by Tom Lehrer.
In an attempt to make the church more commercial.
Tom Lehrer really, he was almost a stand-up comedian. You can hear his, like, full audiences and people, you know, really responding to what he's saying.
What they ought to do is to redo some of the liturgical music in popular song forms.
And he wrote political and topical songs about really serious stuff, but he did it in this twisty way.
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect, and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect.
He's poking fun at the Catholic Church. He had these lyrics that were just killer. 2, 4, 6, 8, time to transubstantiate. I mean...
They're the guy who's got religion. I'll tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer.
I mean, I'm just a nerd. I mean, I was listening to this stuff when I was like 12 years old. You know what I mean? My godmother was a big influence on me and passed these tapes to me. So they have skips in them. I knew all the skips. You know, it was hilarious. And I appreciated them on one level. And then I'd go back at a little bit older and go, oh, that's what he meant by that, you know.
Ave Maria. Gee, it's good to see you.
That's the amazing thing about this kind of music and writing is that you can appreciate it on whatever level you can. My third song is Sitting on Top of the World by the Mississippi Sheiks. So the Mississippi Sheiks are a wonderful fiddle and guitar trio. They were very, very well known in their time in the 20s.
Was all the summer and all the fall, just trying to find my little all in all.
I know that my fiddling has been very influenced by the Mississippi Sheiks fiddling. You know, it just gives you this kind of feeling. There's this rich, rich history of black string band music in America. It goes all the way back to the plantation. And there's lots of people who've heard Adele and all of these people, like, and I love that music too. But, you know, my whole career is based on sort of shining a light in corners of American history. And then you get to the corner and you realize it's actually an entire house, you know.
I'm sitting on top of the world.
The last song for my dinner party is a song by myself and Dirk Powell, and it's called We Could Fly.
Mama, dear mama, look in yonder tree. See that pretty little sparrow looking back at me.
I had been thinking about this African-American folktale called The People Could Fly by Virginia Hamilton. And it was about these people from Africa who could fly, and then they were captured and put on ships and they lost their wings. So at some point, one of the elders remembers the magic words and sings them, and the people who could fly rose up out of the fields and flew away. And the people who couldn't fly, they told the story of the people who could fly to their children, who told it to their children, and so on and so forth. And it's just this beautiful allegory of hope and looking up rather than looking down.
She could fly, she could fly. She could slip the bonds of earth and rise so high. She could fly across the river, the spirit in searching, always searching for the promised land.
A Dinner Party soundtrack from Rhiannon Giddens. Her new solo album, Freedom Highway, is out February 24th. And coming up, we chat with author George Saunders about ghosts of a different kind.
Plus, what does filmmaker Damien Chazelle have in common with biologists?
Well, I think I'm kind of interested in anything that seems on the precipice of extinction.
That and more when the Dinner Party download continues.
Listen what I say. Your granny always told me you feel that way someday.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. Later, revered author George Saunders talks about his new fantastic novel and his first apparently pretty awful one. But first, let's meet our guest of honor.
All right. And this week, it's director Damien Chazelle. His latest movie, La La Land, has been nominated for 14 Academy Awards, tying it with All About Eve and Titanic for the most nominations of all time.
It's an original musical set in modern Los Angeles about a jazz musician who falls for an aspiring actress, both of whom have come to Hollywood to pursue their dreams. Here's a clip from the celebrated opening scene. It's a musical number set on a freeway off-ramp in a traffic jam.
And someday as I sing the song, a small town kid will come along. That'll be the thing to push him on.
Damien's previous movie was the Oscar-winning Whiplash, about a jazz drummer. Jazz, musicals, not the art forms you'd expect a 32-year-old to be into.
It's true.
When I met Damien, I asked him why.
Well, I think I'm kind of interested in anything that seems on the precipice of extinction. You know, whether it's whether it's the musical being called dead, you know, every 5 years or so, movies being called dead, you know, every week I feel like you read another op-ed or something about the death of movies. Of course, that's been the case for 50 years. So, you know, those I don't necessarily buy into those things. And I think the same goes for jazz. I mean, obviously, in this movie, Ryan Gosling's character has a kind of doomsday kind of view of jazz, because he is so obsessed with not really jazz as a whole, but really a very specific subset of jazz, you know, a certain type of very classical or very traditional jazz that flourished in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And yeah, maybe is, as he says, dying today.
Jazz was born in a little flop house in New Orleans, and it just, because people were crammed in there, they spoke five different languages, they couldn't talk to each other. The only way they could communicate was with jazz. I mean, look at these fellas. Every one of these guys is composing, they're rearranging, they're writing, and they're playing the melody. They're just, and now look, the trumpet player, he's got his own idea. And so it's conflict, and it's compromise, and it's just, it's new every time. It's brand new every night. It's very, very exciting.
So I share, I guess, that fascination with things that are either lost or seem like we're in the process of losing them. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's also important, and what I tried to do with this movie, I guess, is to, you know, it's important to embrace modernity as well and to not be rooted completely in the past.
Yeah, you've talked in interviews about how you were trying to strike that balance with the musical form itself, keeping some of the romance and fantasy of musicals, but also trying to incorporate a sort of naturalness. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to set a musical in real life, you know, make a musical about everyday people and about a modern city that's recognizable, that you know, that is the true modern city of Los Angeles, you know, so not shoot the numbers on backlots or sound stages, but really embrace the city itself as a backdrop. And yeah, so it was about trying to thread fantasy and reality, not just in the musical numbers, but kind of in every aspect of the movie. Just try to have the movie hover somewhere between reality and a dreamscape.
You left oil stains on the street, even though maybe a production designer would have wanted to scrub them and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was there always needed to be, I think, a little tension between kind of gritty LA reality and this kind of heightened world that you just necessarily get from doing a full-blown song and dance musical.
Yeah.
And I think what really interested me was, you know, once you kind of set up that dynamic, what does that mean for the characters? What does that mean for the emotions? Because these are characters who are sort of living in their heads. They're kind of living out their fantasies in some way. In other ways, their fantasies remain completely out of reach for most of the movie, you know? And so it's that sort of tension, that frustration, that perpetual state of dreaming where you're kind of frustratingly unable to make the dreams a permanent reality. It felt like the musical was a great vehicle for getting at that kind of feeling that felt, you know, very, in some ways, unique to Los Angeles, I think.
Here's to the ones who dream foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that here's to the mess we make.
This movie took years for you to make. You started it 6 years ago. You had to do a lot of convincing to get it made, and it wasn't until the success of Whiplash that it really got humming. When you were finally assembling the film, did it match the vision you originally had so many years ago?
I mean, the broad strokes, yeah. I mean, the freeway number, at least conceptually, was there in the first draft of the script. All the big set pieces were there, more or less, as you see them on the screen. Some stuff down to the tiniest details. But there was a lot of kind of in-between changes, I think, that happened over the course of, you know, I guess 6 or 7 years between first writing and when I was finally in the editing bay.
So what was one of the details that made it into the final project?
I guess one detail that was there in the very first draft of the script, I remember writing it, was this big piece of decoration in Emma Stone's character's bedroom, that there's this kind of bigger-than-life-size poster of Ingrid Bergman's face kind of hanging right over her bed. And just the way that shot would kind of play out of her tumbling into the bed with that poster above. I think that was there pretty much from the beginning.
Did you put that there specifically because you're a Bergman fan, or was that movie kind of...
Yeah, and it felt like, again, right from the beginning, it felt like she would be a good role model, like a good model for Emma Stone's character for a number of reasons, you know, that sort of... kind of hailing from an era when complex, juicy roles for actresses were more common and considered more commercial than they are today. And also just specifically, in the case of Ingrid Bergman, someone who came from outside L.A., who was very much an outsider to L.A. and outsider to Hollywood, and never entirely actually fit in Hollywood, and kind of had her moment of stardom in Hollywood, but then wound up kind of leaving. It just seemed like it kind of spoke to the wanderer and traveler and kind of a bigger world kind of person that Mia in the movie would be, as opposed to Sebastian Ryan's character, who I always saw as much more of a kind of sort of stick in the mud in both the bad and the good senses of the term.
You know, this movie is critically acclaimed. It's done extremely well at the box office. Besides just being a beautiful work of art, do you have any theories on what's maybe happening culturally that accounts for its success? Why do you think right now people are hungry for this and just so happy to receive it?
I'm not sure, because I didn't really foresee this kind of success. I think all of us making the movie, we felt like the victory was just the first day of shooting, the fact that the plug hadn't been pulled yet and that we were actually being allowed to make it. I guess my hope is maybe it's that kind of naive passion that maybe came across in the film. I hope, I can't really, you know for sure myself, but that maybe came across in the film in a way that's connecting to people. Certainly we're at a time where the idea of pursuing a dream or holding on to a dream, no matter how unrealistic it seems, no matter how unhopeful the world around us might seem, you know, maybe that idea has even added resonance now. Unfortunately. Yeah. So I that might be part of it too. But yeah, I also think people have always underestimated musicals. You know, again, I think that, you know, that all this talk that I've become very familiar with about how musicals don't appeal to most people and how the musical as a genre is dead, et cetera, et cetera, I think actually kind of underestimate the emotional potential of a musical. If you do, you know, musicals really are a very emotional and very emotionally truthful genre because they speak to how we express our emotions. Whether we're musicians or not, we all use music to kind of funnel our emotions. And and so I think there's something very primal about musicals that that, you know, yeah, sometimes is can take people by surprise.
Damien Chazelle, his movie La La Land is up for a record-tying 14 Academy Awards. He's now at work with Ryan Gosling on a new movie about astronaut Neil Armstrong and NASA's mission to land a man on the moon.
That's nice. That'll be a great setting for a ballet sequence, I'll bet.
That's right. The leaps will be
incredible,
tremendous.
By the way, people, Damien's just one of many Oscar-nominated directors we have spoken to recently. Sign up to our podcast on iTunes to hear chats with Ava DuVernay, Raoul Peck, and the man behind Moonlight, Barry Jenkins.
All right, now let's turn to one of the essential ingredients of a dinner party, good manners.
Yes. Each week you send in your etiquette questions, and here to answer them this time around is author George Saunders. He is a bona fide MacArthur genius, and he has won international acclaim for his work in almost every prose form, from hilarious satire to short stories to a children's book. But somehow, his newest work, which is called Lincoln in the Bardo, is his first novel. And George, we are delighted to have you back on the show.
Glad to be here.
So we have to ask, I'm sorry, you're going to be asked this a lot, but what happened that you suddenly went, this one's going to be a novel?
I didn't, but the book kind of did. The book just was like, all right, I need more than 28 pages. And I sort of tried to keep it on a short leash, like, don't bloat up. then there was one day when it got to, you know, maybe 45, and I'm like, I think I like it so far, and we're only an hour into this story, so I kind of just, you know, reluctantly agreed. Because I was kind of digging the idea of just being only the story writer. I think that's kind of like purity in that. But
Was there a moment where you're like, oh no, this is going to be a novel. This is going to take a long time.
You know, when I was younger, one of the first things I ever finished was a novel that it's now a joke in our house. I'll give you an idea of its literary qualities. The title was La Boda de Eduardo, which I think means like Ed's wedding. And I spent a year on it when we were young. 700 pages, you know, and I got through it and kind of ceremoniously handed over to my wife, like, honey, I think you'll see we're sitting on a gold mine here. And she made it about 3 pages in, and I was spying from the next room, and she just was sitting there with her head in her hands. So that made me a little gun-shy about the whole novel idea.
Yeah, it took a while to get off that.
So we're talking about the form, but the story itself, you know, it's about one of President Lincoln's sons, Willie, who died when he was only 11 years old. What made you interested in him?
You know, that was, I years ago, I mean, maybe in the 90s, we were just in D.C. driving past Oak Hill Cemetery, and my wife's cousin mentioned that story, that Lincoln's son had died, and that Lincoln had been so grief-stricken that, according to newspapers at the time, he'd actually gone into the crypt. And the phrase that got me was, on several occasions. So, you know, that I had a writing teacher tell me once that very important to distinguish between the stories you should write and the stories you think you should write. And I had that one in the latter category. You know, it sounded like a nice idea, but at that time, especially as a comic writer, I thought, I don't know.
You've done a lot of satire.
Yeah, it seemed too earnest. And I really felt, I think correctly at that time, that my little tiny bag of talent wasn't quite big enough to take it on. So then about 2012, I had a lot of books out and stuff, and my mind would always go to that little anecdote when I was happy. Artistically happy or personally happy. Really? Just like, oh, that, yeah.
Why?
It's so macabre.
It wasn't, it was the sense of form. Like I could sort of imagine that the crypt and the kind of, just this, I don't know, like the sort of mental image that came to mind. I could just feel that there was something really beautiful and sad, but also maybe even funny in it. And so about 2012, I just had a little talk with myself, like, what is it that's stopping you, you know? And the answer was kind of like, well, you're scared, you're afraid you don't have enough talent, the material is potentially too beautiful for you to, you know, so those are not good reasons to stay away from it. So right. As a kind of a midlife gift, I said, all right, I'm just giving myself 3 or 4 months to fart around with this.
Well, it ends up being almost like a play. The novel reads almost like a play. It takes place in this Buddhist version of purgatory, a bardo, where Willie goes after his death. And it's largely told through the voices of ghosts who join him there. How did you strike upon that as the form and why?
Well, you know, one of the kind of artistic principles that I internalized way back when was the idea that it has to be fun. When you turn your mind to an idea, it's got to be exciting to you. And part of that is that whenever you get to a place where the the storytelling becomes banal or becomes boring to you, you got to veer off like crazy. So when I thought about that Lincoln anecdote, you know, the first thing that came to mind was, well, who's narrating this thing? Because he's the only person there, you know. Right. I didn't want to write a close third person on Lincoln. That just sounds like, you know, like a novella from the point of view of Jesus. You know, it's beautiful, but I couldn't do it. So I became aware pretty soon that the narrators had to be ghosts because there's nobody else in there. And then I found myself really having an aversion to that sentence where you go, a white mass drifted in from the left, you know, or a ghost, a ghost came in. I mean, I never say that they're ghosts. Maybe, I don't even know what they are. They're dead. But it just felt like a speed bump that I didn't want to have to deal with.
It's hard to pull off.
Yeah, so then the idea of just having the whole story being monologues came to me.
You say you wanted to avoid the word ghost, but why choose the word bardo? Are you a practicing Buddhist?
I'm a beginner of practicing Buddhist, I wanted to avoid the word purgatory because I was raised Catholic. And in that tradition, at least as I understood it, purgatory was kind of like detention. Like you screwed up, you know, you have an impure thought, and then you're in the detention for some end of days. And so it's bleak. But in what I had come to understand of Eastern traditions, there was a notion that whatever you experience after death would be closely tied to what your mind was doing right this minute. You know, it's so touching, that idea that you would kick off and then you're still you. And you're like, wait a minute, I can't die now. My book just came out. You know, and I know that would be me. You know, I'm like, I didn't read all the reviews.
You've also, let's talk about some more grounded stuff, though. You've done a lot of nonfiction, much of which involved you getting personally involved with some pretty serious issues. You walked the Mexican border with Minutemen. You spent time in a homeless encampment. You attended Trump rallies, sort of made the case that people there weren't some kind of crazies. How did all that play into writing this book, if at all?
Yeah, so I think that for me, the nonfiction stuff is really important just as a way of kind of keeping myself honest. You know, my thing is, as human beings, one of our safety nets is that we make concepts up about the world. We, you know, we have a political viewpoint, we have a understanding of how things work, which we have to survive. But I think it's pretty good every now and then to just topple that over, get yourself to descend into a state of real confusion. And for me, these trips really help. You know, you think you know what the Trump movement is, you go, you find out you're wrong. You think you know what the border is, you go and you find out you're wrong. Mm. And there's always this beautiful period. It doesn't last very long because I'm a dummy, but a beautiful period where you really aren't sure, you know, where, and you're sitting there with your own uncertainty, genuine, like, shoot, I got to write this thing and I have no idea what's going on. All my tidy ideas in which I was the hero are all overturned. So I think, especially for someone who aspires to write fiction, that's a really good, almost like a house cleaning to do on yourself, a conceptual house cleaning.
George Saunders, his new book is called Lincoln in the Bardo, and the New York Times author Colson Whitehead described it as, quote, a luminous feat of generosity and humanism. Let's just hope George applies those same traits to answering our listeners' etiquette questions.
Yes, he will be back in a minute to do exactly that. Also coming up, I solve some menu mysteries, and we hear a new song from the band Sunkill Moon when the Dinner Party Download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, we'll hear a new track from the band Sunkill Moon, and I decode the mystery ingredients on a new restaurant menu using only the power of asking the chef what they are.
Very Socratic of you.
Thank you. But first, we continue our chat with author George Saunders.
That's right. He just got finished telling us about his new novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, and also that he likes to put himself in confusing situations.
That's
so
right.
That's perfect, because right now we're going to have him answer our listeners' etiquette questions.
You ready for these, George?
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I don't know, to everyone. I don't know. I don't know. What do you think? I don't know.
It'll be the shortest etiquette segment ever.
Please don't do that.
That's a good question.
Here's our first question. It's from Kay in Brooklyn. Very straightforward. Is it okay to dog-ear a book? A teacher once told me
To dog-ear a book.
Like to push down the corner of the page. A teacher once told me that it was disrespectful to the work. It is very convenient, says Kay.
Well, I think if you can get the dog to stand still long enough, it's good. No, I know that feeling, and I think I was told that by a nun at some point. So when I go to do it, that thought arises. And then I guess I feel like, is it better for me to yield to my inner nun and not do it, or better to do it? And then I just ask, well, how would I feel afterwards, you know? So I guess in a sense, I'd say in so many moral questions, the thing is, there's the action and there's the reaction that you have to it. And if you can deal with the reaction, go ahead and do it.
But yeah. I think you're overthinking this a little bit. If it's your book, who cares?
Yeah.
I don't understand. Yeah, but, like, none or no.
But if this person has in her head that, as I do, that it's vaguely disrespectful to the text, then I think you just go, okay, I have that feeling. What's going to make me feel the best afterwards? Mm. And what I do is I tend to go get a bookmark, and then I just feel like, all right.
I think I would weigh whether or not how I would feel dog-earing the book versus getting out of bed in the cold, walking to find a bookmark and put in the book.
Yeah. You're going a long way to satisfy that inner nun, it seems like, George.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kay, if you can live with yourself, dog-ear away. Our next question comes from Andrea in Ohio, and Andrea writes, someone at my book club dominates the conversation. She has the strangest theories about the book sometimes. How do we wrest control from her and let others talk?
An uprising.
Well, I guess one thing would be to consider that she might be correct.
Yeah.
She might be the only one who's right. No, actually, this is sometimes a problem in creative writing workshops, which I teach. And the only answer I know to that and a million other writing critique questions is to move this person's critiques from the general to the specific.
Meaning?
You know, in workshops, someone will say something kind of hurtful. And the only way out of that is to keep asking the person to be more and more specific. So, you know, your story sucks, I hate it, can get talked down into...
General.
Yeah. Can get talked by specifics into, you know, page 4 lags a bit in energy. Mm-hmm. And the latter is very easy to hear. So I bet you if this person was encouraged by the group to sort of be more specific, she might find herself speaking less.
But I see.
Yeah.
Because the problem here is that her theories are weird. Like if you ask her to get more specific, they may just get crazier and crazier endlessly. Yeah.
But they may dissolve because when she really is trying to lay out the logic of her gut reaction.
All right. Well, give it a try, Andrea. I don't know. I think you're doomed. Here's something from Marcus in L.A. Marcus writes, I will often find dirty dishes abandoned in the communal workplace kitchen, many encrusted with oatmeal remnants. We have an idea who this culprit is. Is it okay to call him out? Also, should we set up a trap to catch him in the act? Wow, like a mouse trap.
I think you just hold a meeting. Then you just say, hey, somebody's leaving some crappy dishes in the thing, so let's all remember not to do that. And I bet the person would notice it. Am I being too
optimistic?
Is that
how it works in your household? I mean, if you called a meeting in the household and you're kind of passive aggressive, you're like, someone keeps leaving a cereal bowl.
Well, I think, I don't know if that's that passive aggressive, if they're really not sure who it is. I think it's respectful. You call everybody together and say, without naming anybody, let's just remind ourselves of the communal rules of cleanliness. And actually, you know, after that, if the person does it, I don't see why you couldn't sort of just go up to them and say, Craig, we love you. Uh-huh. And also, Craig, stop dog-earing my book.
I have so many problems with you, Craig.
I think you have it on the key, though. You should go up to him personally. You don't call him out publicly. You don't send an email out to everyone in your workplace going like, guess what?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, that. What is that? I'll quote Mao Zedong, for a retreating enemy, build a golden bridge.
Also, Craig, why don't you eat your oatmeal at home, dude? It takes 5 seconds to make, and you don't need to make it at work.
I'm really terrible at giving advice. My feeling is really that most stuff like this, that, you know, you try anything, and then from the blowback, you can figure out what the next step is. And I'm not big on etiquette advice.
You once parodied advice columns in an essay you wrote called Ask the Optimist, in which you, the columnist, eventually blow a fuse and start ranting at your readers. What was the inspiration for that?
I think it was just something about that American happy-faced feeling, you know, that it's basically denial energy. So everything is wonderful. You know, you drive a spike through my head and I say, oh, thanks for the new coat rack, you know. So that sense that you could never criticize anything or negate anything without being, you know, considered kind of a buzzkill. So that optimist guy was just taking terrible situations and putting this false optimistic sheen on him.
I see.
So it's like actually encrusted oatmeal in a bowl looks beautiful. It looks like it's a special piece of pottery.
That's right. Thank you for this sculpture.
Well, I'm afraid we have to ask you to provide one more piece of advice. Our last question comes from Julia, and she writes in via our website. We don't know where she's from. She says, if a member of your social circle keeps misremembering your name when they bump into you at parties, should you keep correcting them or just roll with it and adopt the misremembered name as a kind of temporary pseudonym?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think I'd probably correct like 7 times. And on 8, you just sort of let it go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you could also purposely call that person by the wrong name.
I kind of like that spirit. There's a person in our office I call Linda, but her real name's Melissa. But I didn't know her name for years. And so she just started listening. Like when I said Linda, she would respond. And now it's just an inside joke that makes me feel bad and remember I misremembered. It's actually a good punishment.
Oh, I see.
But would it work that if she started calling you Larry, would it sort of subtly clue you into the fact that you might want to go back and reconsider?
That sounds like there's a lot of comité there, right? It's kind of like you called me a weird name. Now I'm calling you a weird name. We both are in on the joke now. And now we're both friends and pals.
Oh, I didn't leave the oatmeal in the sink. That was Larry. That wasn't me. ask Linda. She'll tell you.
It wasn't Craig.
George Saunders, thank you so much for telling our audience how to behave.
Well, thank you for helping me tell them how to behave.
George Saunders, his new book is called Lincoln in the Bardo. And by the way, you may have caught his icebreaker joke way back at the very beginning of this episode. Well, we can send jokes of that quality directly to your cell phone.
Quote unquote quality. But yes, just text the word icebreaker to 677-677 and we will respond by texting you back a random gag from our archives. Text message rates may apply. Don't blame us if it's a groaner. You know what you're signing up for.
That's icebreaker to 677-677. Try it out. See whose joke you get.
And now, the main course, the part of the show where we talk about food.
And Brendan, we've been covering food stories for a while now.
Many years, right? Yes.
And it is now to the point where if I'm at a restaurant with someone and there's a weird ingredient or food item on the menu, they will ask me what it is.
And you're like, I only make myself sound smart with editing.
Yeah. Half the time, I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So today, we're launching an occasional series we're going to call Menu Mysteries, where we check out a restaurant's menu and have the chef decode some of the lesser-known ingredients on it. For our inaugural outing, I went to Wolfdown in Los Angeles. That is a new restaurant from Chef Jason Kim. He also runs a place called Forage.
Great guy. By the way, not to gloat, but I had heard of the ingredients you're about to ask him about.
That is true. You had. And we ran them by our newsletter subscribers, and some of them had as well. Nevertheless, many we pulled were unfamiliar with these.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go.
The
first menu item I asked Chef Kim about was a salad with Granny Smith apple, arugula, walnuts, shallots, and here's the stumper, je toast. Is that how it's pronounced?
It's pronounced yay toast, like yay and toast. A very festive sounding cheese.
It's spelled G-J-E-T-O-S-T. The G and jam, imagine, is it a Scandinavian?
Yes, it's a cheese from Norway. Ye, G-J-E, is, I believe, the word for goat. This is a goat cheese. What they do is, when you usually make cheese, you separate the curds and the whey. So what they do is, the whey, they take it and they keep cooking it down.
What is whey?
Whey, it's just the byproduct and the dairy product cream separates. So you get a solid and then you get the liquid whey form. And then whey, nowadays, you see it in powder form, like at nutrition stores, high in protein. But in Norway, what they do is they cook it all the way down until it turns into this brown color. But it's almost like fudgy, sort of caramelly flavor, unlike any other cheese I've ever had. About a year and a half ago, my friend Leah, who owns an awesome cheese store, she introduced me to this cheese. And I was already working on like a caramel apple kind of salad, trying to go for that flavor without making it too sweet, without feeling like you're eating a dessert.
At the beginning of the meal, you probably don't want to have a dessert. This kind of brings up the question, though. Chefs, in a way, are artists, right? But do you have to go so far afield to a Norwegian cheese byproduct to get what you're going for in your mind?
It's not like I try to search for this cheese. It's almost like the cheese kind of found me. I walked into the store, and Leah just said, you have to try this cheese. And on the spot, I was like, this is the final element.
All right, let me take a taste of this. And it's really beautiful. It's got, I guess, those nice little arugula leaves and little chunks of apple. And I guess this is the yay toast on top. Sorry, this is the yay toast on top. I almost don't want to say yay toast. It sounds like something a child would say.
You know what? The first few times, everybody was kind of hesitant to say it, but now it's kind of become a joke. And every time this salad gets fired, we yell yay toast.
Well, if nothing else, it's built some esprit de corps around here. Here's a bite. Oh, yeah. I do taste the sweetness. It's very sweet. It only kind of turns into a cheese flavor on my palate after I've chewed it a little bit. This might be a really good way to get kids into eating salad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, candy salads. That's what we're going for.
All right. Well, before I ruin my dinner with salad, let's move on to the next thing. This is, what are we looking at here?
Okay. This is our patatas bravas.
And on the menu, it says crispy russet potato, paprika, and Skordalia. That is S-K-O-R-D-A-L-I-A. I will tell you that when I first heard that, I thought maybe it was a flower or something. And again, S-K-O also sounds kind of, you know, Nordic to me somehow.
Actually, the Skordalia is Greek in origin.
Oh, right.
A Greek condiment. It's made with like old bread, garlic, lemon juice, almonds, and potato. Almost like a garlic paste sauce kind of thing.
So that's the thing. I'm looking at the plate right now. Yeah. So that is this like sort of arc of creaminess around the edge of the plate.
So that's the Skordalia. So this dish, this is pretty much our glorified French fries. But we wanted to present it with something else that I guess people are not used to having, rather than doing ketchup or aioli or something like that.
Could you not, though, just do a garlic sauce? What is this going to give you that a typical garlic sauce won't?
This sauce actually kind of has some sentimental value to me because when I first started cooking, one of my first paid jobs, I worked at a Greek restaurant. And this is like one of the first things that I cooked. And I was kind of like, wow, this is amazing. It's cool something like this exists.
What about it is so appealing to you?
I mean, first of all, I'm Korean and I eat insane amounts of garlic. We eat raw garlic. I mean, garlic is in everything in Korean food. And, you know, most of my training has been in French cooking. And French is like, yo, you never put too much garlic. You've always held back on the garlic. You don't want to taste any raw garlic. And that goes against everything I grew up and, like, learned to love, you know. So when I started working at this Greek restaurant and I tasted this, I was just like, okay, these guys understand. These guys know. So this is one of the first things that I learned to make at a restaurant that really spoke to me, and it made me feel like, oh, okay, so I don't have to hold back my garlic.
You can express your garlicky soul.
Exactly. So that's one of the reasons why I chose this.
All right, I'm going to take a bite. Nothing fancy about this. I'm just stabbing a delicious-looking golden fried chunk of potato and dipping it in this Skordalia. Oh, that's lovely. And it's a lot... I was about to say...
Yeah, it kicks in a little bit after. So
I was going to say it's milder than a garlic sauce, and that's not true at all.
No.
Chef Jason Kim of the LA restaurant Wolfdown.
I think you still smell faintly of Skordalia.
I may never be rid of it. By the way, several of our listeners in the Midwest say that they have encountered Yay Toast, where apparently it is sometimes sold under the brand name Ski Queen.
Huh. Is that which is nice? Also my favorite ABBA song.
Oh.
Anyway, folks, we'll be quizzing you on upcoming menu mysteries via our newsletter. You should sign up for it via our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
And that's the Dinner Party Download for this week. Next week, Jordan Peele of the comedy duo Key and Peele joins us to talk about his smart and scary new horror film, Get Out. Tune in for that. Also, if you find yourself staring at Facebook this weekend, head over to our page there on Sunday, February 19th, because Brendan will be joining the website Food 52 for a Facebook Live cooking demonstration. Is that right?
That's right. I'll be preparing my trademark Golden Orbs of Ecstasy, a.k.a. Stuffed Olives.
Oh. So
check it out. Till then, we want you to know Jackson Musker is our senior producer. Our associate producers are James Kim and Krista Ripple. Our associate digital producer is Christina Lopez. Our interns are Emerald Douglas and Kathleen McGovern. Big thanks to Bill Lance for engineering. Go get yourself a steak. And now, before we leave you, here's One for the Road, a song to spin on your way to or returning from this week's parties.
Mark Kozelek was the songwriter behind 90s indie band Red House Painters. Since then, he's released a bunch of albums under his own name and under the moniker Sun Kill Moon. That project's new album is called Common as Light and Love, Our Valleys Red with Blood. The songs are almost like diary entries. Here's an example. It's called I Love Portugal.
Who doesn't? Bon appetit.
In my hotel where the band is staying, I'm off the syrup, but what I'd give to not get on that plane. Woke to the sound of birds call and a woman watering her flowers in the garden. And the maid scooting her tray around the Equi Hall. I just want to stay in Portugal today, that's all. Cause when I'm here, there's a sense of calm. People living day to day and enjoying the moment. Last night, we found a cozy place. And we listened to fado music and we ate steak. And Bacala and Calde Verde. Then we went and got gelato. We drank iced latte. And the fans have always shown me love. And so my friends Vasco, Miguel, and Nadia and Monica.
Nadia and Monica.
I can't complain, I get to visit every year. Last night my driver said my music brought him tears. I love Portugal.
Thanks for attending the Dinner Party Download. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. Hey, speaking of menu mysteries, yeah. Did you find out what gratuity included is?
I think it's like a finger food.
Oh.
Yeah.